Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. Today I'm joined by two excellent writers, both award-winning journalists and authors. Both have written books very different that make you stop and think and laugh out loud. My first guest is NPR correspondent Eric Weiner. His book jacket says, "One Grumpy Writer, 10 Countries." Will any of these make him happy? Well, we'll find out in just a moment. Coming up at 12:30, we're joined by Susan Jane Gilman. She's a New York Times bestselling author of Hypocrite in a Poofy White Dress and her latest memoir, Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven. Eric Weiner is my first guest. He spent a decade as a foreign correspondent for National Public Radio. He's been based in New Delhi, Jerusalem, Tokyo, and has reported from more than 30 countries. He's also served as a correspondent for NPR in New York, Miami, and Washington, D.C., and was a former reporter for the New York Times. Weiner's commentary has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the New Republic, Slate, and many other publications. His new book is called The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. Welcome, Eric Weiner.
Thank you, Vicki.
And I wanted to say, first of all, congrats on writing such a great book. I sat at the coffee shop reading most of this and kept laughing out loud to the point that somebody actually came up and asked me what I was reading.
We recommend you don't read it in public places for that very reason.
There you go.
that's a joke. I'm glad you liked it. Thank you so much.
Now, I want to start by quoting you. You believe that place in every aspect of the word shapes us, defines us. You say, change your place and you can change your life. Did you believe that before you wrote this book, or as a result of months of traveling and research for this book?
That's a good question. You know, I have to say I've believed it all my life, at least ever since I was 5 years old and I ran away from home. You know, a lot of five-year-olds threatened to run away. I actually did and got about a mile and a half from my home in Baltimore, Maryland, before the police picked me up. So I've always believed that that we are defined by place, and that likewise, travel can be a transformative experience. I know that, you know, that's perhaps a cliche and it's been overused, but I do believe it. I think travel, when done properly, can change our mood. It can change who we are.
Absolutely, I agree with that. Now, this is a travel book of a kind, but it's not a typical travel book. So would you just explain for our listeners who are not familiar with the work how you would describe it?
I would call it a travelogue of ideas. In fact, some people don't really consider it a travel book at all. What I'm doing is I'm going around the world to 10 countries, but I'm looking for something specific. I'm looking for happiness, or to be more precise, I'm looking at how these 10 different countries define and pursue happiness. So everywhere I go, I sort of have a set of questions in mind that I'm exploring in each country. You know, are they really happy here? If so, why? And how can I get some of that, basically? Because as the subtitle of the book suggests, I'm not a particularly happy person, either a grump or probably malcontent is a more accurate description of me, but my publisher thought malcontent was too many syllables and sounded vaguely French, so we went with grump instead. But the idea is the same. I'm not particularly happy. So, you know, the book was partly, I guess, a bit selfish in that I was looking for the secrets to happiness, and I was doing it the way I've done pretty much everything in my life by, you know, getting on an airplane or a train or a boat and traveling.
Now, a lot's been written about why people are happy or the search for happiness, but not so much where people are happy. Is that what sparked the idea for this book?
Well, it certainly gave me the encouragement that I had stumbled onto some new uncharted territory in the happiness world, because you're right, there is a lot that has been written about who is happy and why, but very little written about where people are happy. And, you know, basically, I know for some people it's a difficult concept because they think, well, you know, people are happy, places aren't happy. And, you know, partly that's true. But if you look at the data on happiness, and there is data, Some places, some countries are consistently happier than others. So they must be onto something. And I was wondering, is it the water? Is it the topography? Or ultimately, as I conclude, is it the culture? Is it the national culture that causes some places and some peoples to be happier than others?
Mm. Now, you say your journey began in a library. Right from the beginning, you started looking at diving. You dove into what classical thinkers thought. So you found that pretty much what they said way, way back then, Aristotle and Plato, etc., pretty much applies today.
It was pretty much what today?
Pretty much applies today. Most of it's relevant.
Extent, yes, in terms of I think that Aristotle was onto something when it comes to happiness, and he wrote a lot about it. But I think back then they had a very different sort of definition of happiness from what we have today. I mean, Aristotle called happiness a virtuous activity of the soul. I mean, he believed that you could not be an immoral person and be happy, a bank robber, a criminal, that they could say they're happy, but they're not really happy. And if you look at our definition of happiness today, we would say, well, yeah, I guess a bank robber could be happy despite their bad deeds. And so really, our definition of happiness today is much frothier. You know, it's much more of the sort of smiley face version of happiness, sort of just hedonism, really. And that's the change that's really sort of accelerated, I think, over the last few decades, especially in this country, I would say.
Yeah, that stuck out to me when I was reading this book, because we'll look at some of the countries in a minute. But you actually started your journey abroad in Rotterdam. You were looking at, who knew there was such a thing, a world database of happiness?
Isn't that great?
Isn't it?
Yeah. Leave it to the Dutch, right, to come up with something like that,
Right.
Right.
And so what did you learn from there to kick you off?
Oh, boy. Well, we can talk for an hour about that. But the World Database of Happiness is essentially the sort of physical embodiment of the science of happiness. Have you heard that term before?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty well known now, although it's, a few decades ago it wasn't. It's basically, sociologists, psychologists, and economists sort of waking up and saying, why are we studying just sick societies and sick minds? Let's study what makes people happy. Let's study healthy, happy people and healthy, happy places. And they do that through a variety of techniques, and they come up with, as scientists are wont to do, a whole lot of data. And if you go to the World Database in Rotterdam, it's sort of all there on hard drives and in journals. And, basically it seemed like the perfect place to start, because they actually have surveys and data going back a few decades on what kind of people are happy. But what really interested me is, where are people happiest?
Mm. And you went to Switzerland from there, and the Swiss believe that envy is the great enemy of happiness. Let's talk a little bit about what you liked about Switzerland, what made you happy, not happy.
Well, I mean, I went to Switzerland because, it did appear quite high on that World Database of Happiness study. They do surveys essentially asking people, how happy are you? And most people, when they think of, the happy European countries, they would probably think of Italy or Spain or, some place where you can, sit in the piazza having your cappuccino. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Swiss, the sort of serious, somewhat dour Swiss, rank considerably higher than the French or the Italian. So that's why I went there. And, I had, preconceived notions of the Swiss, and we all have preconceived notions of most places in the world. I thought of them as being a bit boring. And you get there, and it turns out they're a bit boring, or at least they appear to be from the outside.
Right.
But
we should say that our next guest is living there.
I know.
Because you know her, yeah.
Yes. She's not boring. I guarantee you, Susan Jane Gilman is not boring.
No, actually,
Swiss can be a bit. And everything works well. It functions very well. And so, for the Swiss, at least, that is one aspect of their happiness. It's what the philosopher Schopenhauer called an absence of misery, definition of happiness. And there's an element to that. I mean, the Swiss have a sort of contentment which is not this sort of mercurial, almost manic depressive happiness that a lot of us tend to have. They just sort of hum along. But you mentioned envy, and you're right. I found that the Swiss do not really provoke envy in others. You know, the attitude in this country, in the U.S., is if you've got it, flaunt it. In Switzerland, it's if you've got it, hide it. You know, do not rub your neighbor's nose in your wealth. So while it is a very wealthy country, people don't really show off their wealth. And maybe that's just a function of the fact that they've had, you know, wealthy families that go back 500 years, what we would call old money.
Right.
It's very old money in Switzerland. And I found that interesting. And I found that in my travels around the world that that was true, that countries where there was a large degree of envy tended to not be very happy.
And the Swiss, like a lot of Europe, but you put this under Switzerland, there was a saying, don't shine the spotlight on yourself, you might get shot.
Right.
Which is very different, as you said, from the States, where we do tend to blow our own trumpet.
That's putting it mildly. Yes, we do.
Well, I was being polite. Okay.
Yes.
Let's look at a country that you hated, or I don't know that you hated the country, but you went into a blue funk and it took you a while to come out of that, and that was Moldova. And I found this fascinating reading this because there were so many elements. There was the issue of money and lack of culture, and you came to some great conclusions about this. I wonder if you'd share some of that with us.
Ah, Moldova. Well, I went to Moldova because, again, going from the World Database of Happiness, it was at the very bottom, you know, the least happy country in the world. You know, when they ask Moldovans, how happy are you, on a scale of 0 to 10, the average is about 4, 4.5, you know, while the Swiss are nearly double that. So I wanted to go there and find out, are they really so miserable? And it turns out that, as far as I can tell, they are. I don't know where to begin. I think, if you ask the Moldovans why they're unhappy, they'll say, oh, it's because of the economy. They're not wealthy enough. And on the one hand, that is true. It is not a particularly wealthy country. But it is wealthier than many African countries, yet less happy than quite a few of those African countries. So one thing that's going on is Moldova, you know, it's a former Soviet republic. It's sandwiched between Romania and Ukraine, sort of on the edge of Europe. So it is a very poor country in a very wealthy neighborhood, Europe. And a lot of our happiness and our sense of how we're doing is based on comparison to our neighbors.
Yeah.
So, you know, they don't compare themselves to Tanzanians in Moldova. They compare themselves to Romanians or Italians or Germans.
Right.
And then they don't come out so well. It is a place where there is very little trust of pretty much anyone and anything. And if there's anything I found out about happiness in my travels, it's that trust is hugely important. Could be the most important ingredient in a happy country is trust. And the Moldovans don't have it. Partly, I think that's the result of, you know, many decades of communism. Partly, it's the fact that they don't have a particularly strong culture. They're sort of not quite Romanian, not really Russian either, and they really don't know what they are. And so during tough economic times, they don't have a culture to fall back on. And
yeah,
I think that's hugely important.
It sounded very much as though they have no sense of belonging, really, because as you said in the book, the Russians call them Romanians and the Romanians call them Russian.
Right. And so they don't, you know, there are politicians, senior politicians, government officials in Moldova who don't speak Moldovan. They speak Russian. And so there are problems there. There is corruption, which I don't know if that's a cause of unhappiness or a symptom, but it is so pervasive that it erodes trust. I mean, I've been thinking a lot lately about, you know, why is corruption bad? You know, maybe it's just another form of, you know, organizing an economy. But, you know, I've traveled to a lot of countries where there is a lot of corruption, and it invariably erodes trust. You don't trust anyone. You don't trust the officials or your neighbor. And so that's one of the big problems in Moldova.
Yeah. You also said you were struck by the lack of politeness. You didn't think that was such a big deal at one point, but came to the conclusion, yes, politeness is very much a big deal, and we can't take that attitude, hey, not my problem.
Right. Well, I used to, you know, I lived in Japan for a number of years where politeness is epidemic, I would say. The Japanese are extremely polite. I thought to a fault, you know, because, you know, I didn't really trust the politeness and all those extra words they would throw on to say please and thank you. But after a few weeks in Moldova, I was like, well, I think I would take Japan any day. You know, The politeness is sort of the lubrication that sort of makes society run more smoothly. And, you know, this sort of notion that other people's problems are not your problem, I think, as you suggest, is wrongheaded. I mean, one of the most interesting findings to come out of the science of happiness is that, and this, let's say this slowly and clearly, it goes by quickly, but the quality of a society is more important than your place in the society. So in other words, it's better, you know, to be a small fish in a nice clean pond than a big fish in a dirty one. And so if your neighbors aren't doing well, you think, well, that doesn't affect me. But statistically, you're likely to be less happy in a less clean or pleasant environment.
Mm. Now, how much did money play into it? Because you compare Moldova, which was, you know, the unhappiest place, to Qatar, which is also an unhappy place, as you described, but they're very, very wealthy. But the commonality, I guess, was that neither place had culture.
I think that's right. I never thought about it exactly that way, but you're right. Neither place was particularly well grounded, Moldova or Qatar. Now, Qatar is in the Persian Gulf, and I went there because it is, on a per capita basis, the wealthiest country in the world. It has a very small population, only about 100,000 citizens. Qatari citizens, but, you know, they have so much oil and natural gas that it is as if the entire nation has won the lottery. So I thought it would be the perfect place to examine, you know, this connection between money and wealth. And what I found in Qatar is that people are certainly more comfortable than they were a few decades ago. But there's this sense of disconnection. When you get Qataris sort of in private moments acknowledging it, you know, they will tell you that they feel that human warmth and that sort of Arab, you know, tribal bond that, you know, it's still there, but it's not what it used to be. There's something called a diwaniya, which is an Arab tradition where you get together sometimes every night and you talk. You eat and you talk under a tent or in an air-conditioned building. They used to do it every night in Qatar. Now they only have the time to do it about once a week. There's traffic and congestion and all the problems that money brings. But, you know, can I make one point, though? Because I think that it's not that the poorest people in the world are the happiest.
Right.
This is the problem. When I talk to people about money and happiness, a lot of people sort of assume or will suggest that they have that the very poorest of the world are the happiest, even though they have nothing. And statistically and through my observation, that's not true. You know, a really poor country in Africa, the best way to make them happier is to give them more money, or ideally, of course, have their economy grow.
Mm.
And that's true, you know, for a person or for a country up to a certain point. But then beyond that point, you know, it's the law of diminishing returns. More money yields hardly any more happiness beyond a certain point. And that point, they found, is at about $15,000 a year.
Oh, interesting.
Overall.
That's not a lot of money either, is it?
Not a lot. But if you're making $500 a year, you know, you have a ways to go. But
yeah,
if you're a country like the U.S. or the U.K. or Switzerland, we're sort of well beyond the point where, you know, money's going to have this huge effect on our happiness.
Yeah. I know when I'm talking with people, they always think, oh, it must be wonderful to live, you know, in Jamaica or the Bahamas or Fiji, where the climate is so beautiful and the beaches are so wonderful. But they ranged in the middle of the country. One of the coldest places, Iceland, rated at the top.
Well, this was one of the surprises and, frankly, a disappointment to me, because I thought I'd spent lots of time in Fiji and Jamaica researching the happiest places. And then I get to the World Database of Happiness, and they're telling me, no, it's Iceland, Denmark, Switzerland, you know, these cold, dark places. It turns out that, you know, our idea of paradise is wrong. You know, it is not really the Fijis and Jamaicas of the world that are the happiest. We just think they are because we're living, you know, in Seattle in January, and sure, it looks good, you know?
That photo looks real good.
Yeah, but that's a focusing illusion, as the psychologist would call it. You're focused on what you don't have. You know, you're focused on that beach in Jamaica or Fiji or wherever, and you're not looking at the problems they have, whether it's crime or corruption or whatever. And in fact, climate does not matter that much. In fact, there's an argument and a theory that colder places tend to be happier because, you know, from an evolutionary point of view over the centuries, life was very difficult and people had to cooperate, so they had to build these bonds of trust in order to survive. You know, now they have air conditioning and heating and all that, but that sort of foundation of trust is there.
I watched Chef Anthony Bourdain on he has a show called No Reservations.
Yeah.
And when he went to Iceland, he too saw that they were very happy, but he blamed it on the beer. Why do you think they're so happy?
He credited the beer.
He credited, okay. We'll credit, yes. Credit the beer.
Okay, I wouldn't blame the beer in this case. I would credit it. Well, they do drink like fish, but only on the weekends, only on Friday or Saturday evening. It's a very binge mentality, or bracketed indulgence, as they like to call it. You know, on a Tuesday or Wednesday evening, they wouldn't even touch a beer or a glass of wine. But on the weekends, they do drink heavily. They've had this sort of feast or famine mentality for a long time. And, you know, that's the way life was. And I think it's one of the reasons why I think they're, from a cultural or social point of view, weathering their current economic crisis pretty well, given that it's much worse than it is in the U.S. But the country has not fallen apart. And, you know, they've got their culture to fall back on, and they've got their beer, too, to see them through.
One of the things I found interesting, of course, was when you went to England.
Yes.
To Slough, of all places. But there was a very
You're not from Slough, by any chance, are you?
No, who goes to Slough? But there was a very specific reason you went there. And
right.
I was just amazed at, you know, the BBC and people that paid for this project, the BBC project, took this so seriously that they actually put a documentary together. So tell us a little bit about what you found in England.
I guess indirectly, British taxpayers, or what do they call it, the license fee payers, paid for that.
Yes, really.
It was a project called Making Slough Happy. Now, Slough, for those of people who may not know, is, and correct me if I'm wrong here, it's sort of the New Jersey of the UK.
Pretty much.
Yeah, only not as nice.
Well, I haven't been to New Jersey, so I can't compare.
Okay,
It's the armpit is what we call it.
Right, it's just in the backyard of Heathrow Airport. Not quite suburban London, just on the outskirts of that. The Office was filmed there, right, to give you an idea. And there's a famous poem from the 1930s that sort of pokes very hearty fun at Slough.
Oh, John Betjeman, yeah.
That's why the BBC chose it as sort of an experiment. Can you take this unhappy armpit of a place and make it happier? And I found that concept fascinating, and I wanted to follow up and find out, you know, is Slough any happier? You know, can you change a place? In other words, I'm going around the world looking at these places, but is it all fluid? Can you take a Moldova and turn it into an Iceland? Can you take Slough and make it something happier? And so I went to follow up, you know, after the BBC happiness experts had, you know, descended on the town and then left, whether Slough was any happier.
And?
I think the conclusion is not really.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's a flaw of the sort of happiness project where they, you know, they chose like 50 volunteers from Slough and put them through all these kind of silly exercises. I mean, the British people are not usually the hugging type. Would that be correct?
Yeah, probably for the most part, yeah.
Yeah, right. But they had them hugging each other and dancing and doing things. And
they were probably standing there saying, I feel stupid.
Right, right. So they're trying to break down their inhibitions, and it wasn't necessarily pretty to watch. And the idea was that these 50 then happier, uninhibited Sloughites would then, you know, circulate among the citizens of Slough and like a virus, you know, spread happiness.
Spread the happiness.
Yeah, it never quite worked out that way. But I found, personally, I think the British are happier than they let on. I think you just don't like to show it.
That's right. We like to keep you guessing.
Exactly. And then if a British person does smile, you know they probably really mean it. You know, while an American doesn't mean anything, right?
Right. Well, I want to ask you, because we're almost at the end of the segment, but I want to ask you what you learned about your own country, about America, when you were doing this project.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I learned, and it's going to sound kind of counterintuitive, especially for someone who wrote a book about happiness, is that we think too much about happiness in this country, or that we, instead of focusing on living a quote-unquote good life, all that entails, we focus on the byproduct, which is happiness. And, you know, I found as I traveled the world, the countries that are the happiest tend not to think about it too much, while in this country we are pretty much obsessed with happiness, and we define it as personal happiness. You know, we use that term, personal happiness, and I met a man in Bhutan named Karma who told me, "Eric, this is ridiculous. Why do you Americans talk always about personal happiness? There's no such thing as personal happiness. It is 100% relational. It's our relationships, and it's a different way of thinking about happiness, and I think we'd all be better served if we never used the term personal happiness again and didn't even think or conceive of our happiness in that way.
Well, I have to tell you, this was a great book. It made me stop and think, and it made me laugh out loud several times. I mean, all the way through.
Even in the UK chapter.
Oh, especially in the UK chapter.
There you go.
If there's one thing us Brits can do, it's laugh at ourselves.
I notice you're not living in the UK, though, are you?
No.
Okay, enough said.
I knew that. Okay. Well, you know, when you went on your trip at 5 years old, I knew at nine I wasn't going to be living there.
So. There you go.
Well, I want you to give out your website to our listeners, because there's a lot of great information on there.
Eric Weiner, www, of course, ericweinerbooks.com, ericweiner, books, all one word, .com. Got some photos of Bhutan, which we didn't have time to talk about, which is an amazing place in the Himalayas. And
interesting also, use of phallic symbols there, too.
Yes, that's probably why we didn't talk about Bhutan.
Well, I looked at the pictures, yeah.
Okay, and also there's a place where you can tell me what your happiest place is, and then I try to compile them and put them all there. And it's kind of fascinating reading. I've received hundreds and hundreds of replies from people about what their happiest place is, and so, you know, let me know.
All right. Well, we really appreciate you being with us today, and good luck with the book.
My pleasure. Thank you, Vicky. Be happy.
Yes. My guest, Eric Weiner, his website, again, ericweiner.com, and his book, The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. This is a really great read. It's going on my favorite bookshelf. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Susan Jane Gilman. She, too, is an award-winning journalist and author, and you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Thank you.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
The ever-popular Dr. Bernie Siegel returns to Conversations Live next week to share what's happened to patients who followed his advice in love, medicine, and miracles. In his latest works, Faith, Hope, and Healing, Dr. Siegel shares inspiring stories of people who found deeper faith, hope, joy, and healing. That's coming next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for details.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Alternative to what? Alternative to everything else out there on the radio, Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my second guest is Susan Jane Gilman. She's the best-selling author of Hypocrite in a Poofy White Dress and Kiss My Tiara. She's written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and Ms. Magazine, among others. And her fiction and essays have received several literary awards. Her new book is called Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven, and it's a memoir. Susan Jane Gilman, welcome to the show.
Hi, Vicky. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I was just telling you, this was purely coincidental, but Eric Weiner, my first guest we had spoke with today, had blurbed the back of your book, and I mentioned it to him. And you guys just had lunch last week, right?
We did. It's funny because when he came to Switzerland, that's where I'm based at the moment. So I helped show him around one of the supposedly happiest places on earth. And it's always unnerving when you send a friend a book to blurb. You say, don't blurb this unless you like it. And I held my breath, and he said, not a problem. He loved it. So, you know, we're still friends.
Yeah, well, it was a very interesting book, very different journey to Eric Weiner's. But again, a book that made me stop and think and in places made me laugh out loud. So, well, before we get into your book, what is Switzerland one of the happiest places in the world to live?
It is, but you wouldn't know it. The Swiss are very good at hiding their light under a bushel, and that's strategic.
There you go. Strategic for what?
Well, they don't want to show off. They have a really good thing going here and don't want to call attention to themselves. They're not like Americans. You know, we have the best and the brightest of everything all the time, and we can't wait to tell you. The Swiss, the opposite.
Mm. So I want to just let's dive into your book here, Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven. This is a memoir, as I said, and it actually takes place more than 20 years ago, I think, now.
Right, 1986.
Yeah, so it reads like a novel. Tell us a little bit about the journey that you went on. Just give us a synopsis of the book, and then we'll go deeper into it.
Sure. 1986. I'm fresh out of college. I have a friend who I know, who I don't know terribly well, also from college. We don't know what to do with our lives. So we decide we want to take an epic journey around the world. We want to have a great adventure. And unlike most Americans who will jump into a car and drive west or leave their hometown or go to Europe and trek around with a backpack, we wanted to do one better. And so we decided we would circle the globe and start in the People's Republic of China. And at that point, China had just opened up for independent tourists. It was the first time you could go without government escorts and alien travel permits. And the country was still really walled off from the rest of the world. There was no news coverage out of it, no photographs, no television feed. Some of the parts of the country had no electricity. Certainly, you know, this was two decades before internet and cell phone. So we plunged headlong into this totalitarian communist country. We spoke no Mandarin. We knew nothing about Asia. And we went sort of just to kind of like conquer the world and have this wild trip. And instead, the world conquered us. And we started to disintegrate when we were there. And I fell apart physically, and my friend started to unravel mentally, and we went deeper and deeper into China and got deeper and deeper into trouble.
Mm. And I read that your journey really began in a local IHOP at 4 a.m. in the morning when you were drunkenly looking at placemats.
Doesn't everybody? Yeah, you know, we didn't know what to do with our lives, so we went and, you know, got drunk and ordered chocolate chip waffles, and they had these placemats that said something like pancakes of many nations. And we said, hey, we should go to many nations and eat pancakes and all of them. You know, this is what passes for genius when you're 21 and you're inebriated. And that's how we started writing down on the back of the placemat every place we ever dreamed of going. And most of these, Vicky, I couldn't even locate on a map. I couldn't tell, you know, I couldn't tell Bali from Barbados, from Baruda. But we just wrote down what sounded cool, and China seemed like the coolest and the most inaccessible and rough and unknown of all. So we thought, oh, well, let's start there.
Mm. So how did you go about even beginning to reconstruct this? Because 20 years is a long time, and to, you know, you can recollect a story for maybe 5 minutes, but to put a whole book together, what was involved in pulling all the data back together?
This is a good question, because there have been a lot of false memoirs out there, and it was very important for me to write the truth as best as I could. I had some help in that I kept a journal when I was in China. I'd already had the idea that I was going to be a writer, so this was going to be my epic journey. I was going to be Kerouac, right, or you know, or Mark Twain. So I kept extensive notes. And the fact is, though, I was 21, so when I went back over them, I saw a lot of the notes were just me pining away for boys back in America, you know, who I'd had a fling with before I got on the plane. So it was like, oh, I wonder if Josh still likes me. Now we're in the Forbidden City. Oh, I wonder if he got my postcard. But I did manage to take extensive notes, so that was part of it. I also went back to China in 2005 and retraced my steps, and that helped. I also was able to track down several people who were instrumental to saving our lives, and I found them, even just as the book was going to press, and I had them vet things, and we ran it through fact checkers. And the other thing, Vicki, is I might forget your name. You can tell it to me 40 times, but I'll remember when I met you what we were wearing, what we were eating, a joke you might have told me. I have very good sort of episodic memory, so that helped a lot. And between all of that, I managed to put together... I mean, the phrase memoir sounds so pretentious. You know, you should be 80 and have lived through the French Resistance and had several lovers if you write a memoir. But it's the best word for your truth as best as you can recollect it based on the truth.
Right.
So there you go.
Right. Different to biography and autobiography,
right,
which are based solidly on proven facts, etc.
Right, but I don't like say I was in prison for 3 months if I wasn't, or that I was dealing
right.
drugs in South Central LA when, in fact, you know, I went to Beverly Hills High School. It's as best as I recall it, based on all the facts as I could regather them.
Yeah. Now, where did you get the title from, "And Dress Me in the Temple of Heaven"?
Well, there's the sexy version and the meaningful version. Which should I start with?
It's the sexy one.
Of course. Good. Well, I did have a fling with an Australian sailor in Shanghai, and we had plans to meet in Beijing. And the Temple of Heaven, as you know, is their big ancient landmark temple. It's one of their great symbols, sort of, you know, like the Vatican or Notre Dame. So he had told me he'd wanted to undress me in the Temple of Heaven. So on one hand, it speaks to all the wild, sort of transgressive adventures that I dreamt of, the romance of travel. But then the meaningful version is that we were, in fact, just stripped down, my friend Claire and I. We found ourselves completely without any of the tools at our disposal we're used to for surviving. We couldn't speak the language. We couldn't read. We were going hungry most of the time. We were under government surveillance, and we were cut off from our friends and our family. And we were really made vulnerable and humbled. So that's the second part of Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven, about what it means to be stripped of everything in a foreign country. It's the romantic ideal versus the reality.
Yeah. And when you and Claire went, you didn't really know one another. I think I read you'd known one another about 4 months. Is that correct?
Well, we had been in the same freshman dormitory at Brown. So, you know, we lived on the same hall at different ends, and we took a class together. And Claire was one of those people, we had a very similar sensibility and a sense of humor. And we would bump into each other once a semester on campus, and we'd go out for coffee, and we'd say, oh, we have to get together. And then we never would. We were in completely different social circles at school. And we kept meaning to become better friends, and then the next thing we knew, we were graduating. And hey, you know, she hadn't won a Rhodes Scholarship, and I hadn't written the great American novel yet, so what else did we have to do? Get drunk, go to the IHOP, and plan a trip around the world.
Right. You say now that you believe that travel humbles us and expands our understanding. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, if we're lucky, it does, because I do see tourists who sort of come, and I guess all groups are guilty of this. I see it mostly with me and my fellow Yankees who walk around and, you know, ask for Coca-Cola and hamburgers. But when you travel, the minute you step outside your country's borders, your IQ essentially plummets. Everything that that we take for granted, that we know, that we understand, simple ways of behaving, greeting people, let alone if there's a different language involved, different codes of behavior, things that we, you know, reading a bus map, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've stood at a bus stop and gone, is this the bus stop? You know, pointing to the bus stop.
Right.
Or you pantomime, you know, eating and pointing to a sandwich. You're reduced sort of to an infant. You're kind of helpless. And if you're open to the experience, it's very humbling, but also like when you're a child, it opens you up to everything. You have to relearn and re-see the world. And, I mean, I find travel incredibly anxiety-producing, but also it's just a drug of choice. I mean, it's exhilarating. You know, you're constantly learning things, so it's both.
Mm. There were some very, very harrowing experiences on this trip, which I'd like to look at a couple of them later on. what did you come back a changed person? I think you must have done. And do you think you'd be the person you are today without that experience?
I definitely changed. It gave me, when I first started out, the first thing I did the night we arrived in Hong Kong was curl up in a fetal position and then call home in tears saying, I've made a mistake, I have to come home.
Right.
I was just freaked out. And by the end of it, I realized that I was stronger than I had thought, and I continued to travel. And that's changed my life. I mean, I've been a journalist overseas. When I've been teaching, I've led high school students through the British Isles. Lucky you. And I've traveled all over the world, and I live abroad. I couldn't have done any of it if I hadn't survived China. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really a book, you know, if you're going to paint it in broad terms, about surviving and surviving things you think you can't possibly, or finding yourself in circumstances that you never anticipated, never dreamed of, without any of the tools at your disposal. And in that way, I mean, I'm hearing from readers that it's scarily relevant to people today, even if they haven't left their hometown.
Oh, sure. Now, Claire was from a privileged background, your traveling companion. You grew up in subsidized housing, attended university on financial aid. How
right.
did that play into the dynamics of your relationship? Because I know there were times in the beginning where she definitely supported you, but it kind of flip-flopped toward the end, I think.
Right. Well, she supported me, I mean, not financially, but emotionally.
Right.
And the tension between us, I mean, you know, here's a surprise. Hey, we were from different classes, and there was tension between us. Some of it was because she had an ease in the world that I didn't and that I very much admired. And in the beginning, she was the one who said, look, we're young, we're brilliant, we're beautiful, we're educated, we have credit cards. Come on, if we can't make it in China, who can? And she really had that kind of can-do American optimism of going forward, which I, having always felt like an outcast, you know, scholarship kid, or, you know, I grew up white in a mostly tough Hispanic neighborhood. I was used to always being the outcast, and I didn't feel entitled at all.
Mm.
As we started to travel, though, what was interesting was because I was used to being the only white face on a crowded city block, I felt at home in China.
Right,
you know,
right.
we stood out. The Chinese at that point hadn't seen Americans or Westerners, and they would just surround us, kind of pointing, not rudely, you know, we're just staring. We were the freak show. We were a curiosity. And it really freaked Claire out. And for me, I was, oh, okay, crowds. Everybody was like jostling and trying to talk to us and arguing among themselves. Yeah, it's like being on the streets of New York. And the way that I had grown up, I think, better prepared me for that. But we had tension about money because she would kind of wave it around and assume, well, you know, worst comes to worst, I'll just take out a credit card. And I had worked to get around the world. I'd worked as a cocktail waitress at night in a sleazy bar. I'd worked as a paralegal during the day, you know, kill me now. And, you know, so for me, I had a different relationship. Every penny we spent was a penny I had earned.
Right. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to look at some of the characters and some of the escapades that you encountered. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest is Susan Jane Gilman. She's the author of Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk podcast reviews brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk podcast today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Susan Jane Gilman. She's the author of Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven. And a funny book, sometimes harrowing stories in here. It's a memoir. And I wanted to ask you, Susan, if you'd share a couple of your favorite escapades with us. The situations that made you challenge the most.
Oh, there were so many. Probably, and this one, I can't say it's my favorite and that I would want to live it again, but that it really woke both myself and Claire up, was when we wound up in a rural hospital in the middle, the depths of China. We had ventured off the map, and she had fallen ill, and it was very hard to find anybody who spoke any Mandarin, let alone English, because everyone spoke dialects. And we were taken, finally, by the one English-speaking teacher in the entire village of 830,000 people to their hospital. And we found ourselves sort of in a barracks with dirt floors and chickens hopping around and people lying on pallets with oxygen taped under their nose, just lying out on the dirt floor, and other
wow.
people with cooking and smoking and spitting and screaming. And to us, I mean, I grew up around a certain amount of urban poverty. It wasn't that far from where I grew up, but this was like nothing I'd ever seen. It was medieval. And so I can't say that was my favorite, but it was definitely one of the most evocative.
Mm. You ran into a lot of characters through your travels. Who was one of your favorites?
Oh, well, one of them was a Canadian nurse named Sandy Fenton, who, you know, it was just sort of efficiency personified. And, you know, she had that, I don't know if I can do a Canadian accent justice, but she'd be like, oh, lordy, lordy, you've gotten yourself into some trouble there, haven't you, eh? And she came to our rescue, you know, in the most unlikely of ways. And, you know, and she offered to help us, except that I don't want you making any Canadian jokes, you hear me? If you say one bad thing about maple syrup or ice hockey or curling, your little red, white, and blue butt is going to be on the next boat. And I just, you know, she sort of swept in, you know, as a superhero, and I'm actually going to be reunited with her in 2 weeks. I tracked her down when I was finishing the book, and we found her living in Australia. And my husband has some business in Melbourne, and I called her. So I'm coming down, and we're going to be reunited for the first time in 22 years.
Wow, that would be awesome. Now, you've been back to China since then, as you said. And I remember reading in the book, you said that, I can't remember the exact number, but it was 1 or 5 years had passed, but China had progressed 20 years.
Actually, the ratio was I hadn't been back in 19 years, but China had progressed at least a century.
There we go.
I mean, Vicki, I was walking around and I said to my husband, how did I not remember this? This wasn't here. This wasn't. Do you think, can you get Alzheimer's at my age? It was as if, I mean, there was a part of Shanghai when I was there in 1986, you'd look across the river from an area called the Bund and you'd see nothing. It was flat. It was mud flats. Now, when you see that iconic picture of Shanghai with, you know, there's that big sort of like TV tower space needle and all those high rises, that is the same area. That's Pudong. And we came in on huge 8-lane highways and skyscrapers, and the tallest buildings from 1986 are now these cute, quaint, old little colonial buildings fronting the river. There were cities that I went to which had been villages, and now they have lakes in the middle with these gold and silver pagodas rising out of them. And I said, these were these here? How did I forget the pagodas? How did I forget the lake? And they'd say, oh, no, we built those 5 years ago. It's so much prettier, isn't it? I mean, the Chinese have just renovated on a massive scale their architecture, their geography. Their cities, at least Shanghai and Beijing, make, and this is blasphemy because I'm a native New Yorker, they make Shanghai makes New York look old and quaint.
Huh, interesting.
I mean, yeah, I expected to see little flying saucers, you know, circling the Space Needle. It was really jaw-dropping.
Yeah, I've only seen it on the documentary film, and it is spectacular. I mean, just out of this world. Did you, and I don't mean that necessarily in a good way, but do you think that putting 20 years perspective, hindsight, gave you better perspective on this?
Absolutely. I mean, people are asking me, well, why now? Why did you wait 20 years? And part of it is that, you know, traumatic things happened to Claire and I, and we ourselves behaved badly as well. So I just needed some distance to get my brain around it, but I really felt an urgency to write it in 2003 when, you know, the U.S. was talking about the war in Iraq and that it would be a cakewalk. And when I heard the phrase cakewalk, I turned to my husband. I said, what are they, two 21-year-old girls in the IHOP? That sounds like something idiotic I would have said. And I had a sense, you know, that we Americans, we do have the idea we can just march into another country and prevail. Mm. And this isn't just political. I mean, there's a whole spate of books, you know, with due respect to my fellow best-selling authors, about people who go and buy a Mediterranean villa and renovate it to get over their divorce, or go and eat a lot of pasta in Tuscany, or then go to an ashram to get over heartbreak. And we have this idea that foreign countries are just there really for our own personal makeover and our own enrichment, and that you just go and they're colorful ethnic people, and it's all this easy, breezy self-help adventure. And I wanted to write responsibly about what it can also mean to be a stranger in a strange land and step into a foreign country that is vastly different from our own, and how travel isn't about conquering, it's about surrendering. And I wanted to show the opposite side of that and puncture this American myth we have of just sort of showing up.
Yeah, and we've laughed about some of the situations that you've run into, but you also ran into some very desperate situations. As you said, you were under government surveillance. Your friend Claire became psychotic. Tell us what happened with her.
Well, I didn't see it as it was happening because I was 21-year-old drama queen, and you know I was used to a really high level of operatic behavior from myself and my friends. But she became paranoid, and it wasn't readily apparent because there were reasons to be paranoid in China. We were constantly watched. You know, I wrote postcards home, and only the ones that were completely positive made it through. Letters I sent home were opened, you know, and you could tell they made no bones about writing, scribbling on it, censoring things. We would get into hideous trouble, and all of a sudden, somebody from the military service would show up. So she became paranoid and convinced that we were in danger, and I didn't see it for a long time. I thought, as you do when you're 21 and a little narcissistic, ugh, she's just jealous because I met this cute guy, or oh my God, you know, she's just acting up again, you know, and I dismissed a lot of it. And it wasn't until things got really out of hand that I had to say, oh my God, you know, my friend is coming apart. Plus, she had been the stronger one of the two of us, you know, and I make no mistake about that. And so I just thought, oh, she's just being kooky. Oh, China's just getting to her, because it was getting to me, too. We were hungry and physically uncomfortable and sick a lot of the time.
Yeah. She actually called you a hypochondriac in her journal.
Yeah. Some things haven't changed, Vicky, I have to say.
Well, you are a seasoned traveler. I don't know if you've been all over the globe, but you've been some places.
Yeah.
What kind of advice do you give to young people? My nephew spent a whole year in Australia last year, and he's just about to head out to New Zealand for another year. What advice do you give to young people stepping out?
Do more homework than I did, and that's a lot easier these days with Google Earth and the internet and, you know, a whole spate of books. Always learn a little bit of the local language, the words please and thank you. Whenever I've learned them in Slovenian and Russian and Swahili and Egyptian, whenever Arabic, whenever you can just make the smallest amount of effort, people really unbar to you. I would say don't go with an agenda, whether it's, you know, convert the natives to Christianity or stick to your vegan diet or prove something to somebody back home. Just go with sort of an open mind and an open heart. it's very counterintuitive because travel is about being out of control. And my first impulse, because I'm a nervous traveler for all my traveling, is to, you know, is to sort of like get a stakehold and set up a plan. Whereas what you really have to do is sort of hang back and let the world carry you a little bit.
Yeah.
At the same point, I mean, don't be an idiot. Don't get into, you know, a taxi without a meter and without negotiating a price, or, you know, three men who want to take you into a back alley. Don't do things that you blatantly wouldn't do at home. But barring that, sort of be open, be humble, be prepared.
Good advice, good advice. And great experience. What would you like to leave our listeners with? I'd like you to give them that your website for one.
Certainly. It's SusanJaneGilman.com. And from there, you can access my blog, A View from Abroad. Get it? Ha, ha, ha. So bad. But, you know, all about perspectives of traveling, of being a stranger in a strange land, hopefully with a bit of humor as I go around the world, as I do. Mostly, I really wanted to write a book that was sensitive, that was funny, that would give everybody an escape, and that's a sense of comfort to people right now, because people I know are going through a really rough time.
Yeah.
And as I said, you know, it's a book about surviving what you think you can't. So if you have a laugh at my expense, you learn a lesson, you escape to China with me for a little bit, and you feel better, I've done my job.
And I can see why after hearing your Canadian accent, why the Seattle Post-Intelligencer has said, publisher's frantic search for the female David Sedaris may have finally come to an end. What a compliment to you, Susan.
Oh, huge compliment to me. Maybe an insult to David Sedaris, but, you know.
Well, thanks for being with us today. And I want to thank everyone for tuning in today. We'll be back next week on Conversations Live. You can find out who's coming at conversationslive.net. And you'll find more Book Talk podcasts and show archives at conversationslive.net. Thanks for being with us.
The ever-popular Dr. Bernie Siegel returns to Conversations Live next week to share what's happened to patients who followed his advice in love, medicine, and miracles. In his latest works, Faith, Hope, and Healing, Dr. Siegel shares inspiring stories of people who found deeper faith, hope, joy, and healing. That's coming next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for details. Views